Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, 40 million reasons to use cash only. And yes, Target shoppers, I am looking at you. Farewell to the incandescent bulb and a conversation from the Etsy corner office. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday. Today is the 19th of December. This is the podcast for that date. Thanks for being with us. I thought for a minute this morning about starting off by just reading you my credit card number. I figure since I've done some shopping at Target the past couple of weeks, you know, just about the same thing, right? The company admitted today hackers somehow stole details of more than 40 million credit and debit card accounts during the 2 weeks just after Thanksgiving, which raises, among many others, this question. What does somebody do with 40 million credit cards? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
If past experience is any indication, those 40 million stolen credit card numbers are going on one heck of a ride.
That data has been flowing primarily to Eastern Europe, to the former Soviet bloc.
Kevin O'Brien is with cloud security company CloudLock. He says Eastern Europe has become the epicenter for malware that can steal financial info.
These hackers post these programs or the output from these programs for sale.
Who buys it? In this case, people back here in the U.S. Among them, this guy.
My name is Brian Krebs.
He's an investigator and reporter with KrebsOnSecurity.com.
I'm working with a financial institution to buy some of their stolen cards from the underground.
All of the stolen credit cards he has bought so far have turned out to be from the Target breach.
These cards are selling like hotcakes right now.
He says the card numbers are sold in bulk for up to $100 a piece, and the transactions are extremely sophisticated.
You tell them what banks you're interested in, and they'll tell you how many of those cards from those banks that they have. And then you sort of put them in your shopping cart, pay with bitcoins, and you're off to the races.
It's basically like a criminal eBay.
It'll really blow your mind.
Sadly, most people who buy card numbers aren't Brian Krebs. They're organized groups of criminals.
What you're seeing in fraud attacks are much more organized plays. I think that's the biggest takeaway.
Brian Riley is with CEB Tower Group. He says consumers should watch their balances like a hawk. I asked Riley if he would cancel his card.
Absolutely.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Excuse me, I got to go check my credit card account, right? All right, moving on. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his annual end-of-year press conference today. It went, I kid you not, for hours. But the real news came after it was almost all over. Putin said he's going to pardon one of his best-known political opponents, a one-time Russian oil tycoon named Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Khodorkovsky's been in jail for a decade or more on charges of fraud and tax evasion. Suspicions are that Putin is showing his softer side leading up to the Olympics in Sochi this coming February. The BBC's Rafael Sokov is in Moscow. Rafael, good to speak with you.
Hi, thank you.
Politics are obviously at the heart of what's going on today with Mr. Putin and Mr. Khodorkovsky. But back 10 years ago, when Khodorkovsky was arrested, he was an economic force in that country, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right. He was the owner of the oil giant company Yukos. And, of course, now he's considered by many to be Russia's longest-serving political prisoner. When Vladimir Putin was consolidating power in his first term as president, Khodorkovsky did not flee like some oligarchs have done.
You mentioned the oligarchs, which were very big as the Russian economy was changing, and these men were getting very, very rich with the government's permission, I suppose. Are they still around, these oligarchs?
Yes, of course. Most of them are really close to the Russian government, and they have different occasions. They work with government, they finance Olympics, they are one of the sponsors, and they have built venues for Olympics. So, of course, they are around, and only Khodorkovsky is missing.
What is left of Yukos, his oil company?
No, nothing has been left, so Khodorkovsky has nothing to come out with jail to have something.
Because you were there, what was the scene like at this marathon press conference that President Putin had today? It went hours and hours and hours, and then at the end he delivers this news about Khodorkovsky, right?
Yes, you see, and he even did not deliver. The press conference has been finished, and when he was already leaving the room, some journalists just got around him, asked the question about Khodorkovsky, and then Putin answered what he answered. He said that he's already been in detention for more than 10 years and that it is a serious punishment and that his mother is ill now. That's why he's asking for pardon. And now his lawyers and his representatives say that they were unaware of any such request. So that's still mysterious, and it was really a big surprise for everybody.
Is there a chance, do you suppose, that Khodorkovsky becomes some kind of rallying point for dissidents and maybe even for other oligarchs who want to see political change there and use economic means to get there?
I can't say about other oligarchs because that's really difficult to predict. But as for Khodorkovsky, everybody thinks, and lots of people here in Russia think that Khodorkovsky will stay on political stage. People here really wait for Khodorkovsky to just see whether there can be any competition, maybe for the Russian throne.
Interesting, you use the word throne.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
This is the Russian throne.
Rafael Sakov at the BBC Russian Service in Moscow. Thank you so much, Rafael.
Thank you very much. Bye. Good luck.
Taper plus one, and Wall Street is still mostly happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was quite the hue and cry on Twitter at the beginning of the week. People up in arms about Uber, the car service, and the price of a ride. Specifically, them charging more when there is more demand. On New Year's Eve, for instance, where a car ride that's usually, I don't know, $20 ends up costing you maybe $100. Or in this specific case, raising prices in bad weather, as it did last week on the East Coast. Harvard Business Professor Nancy Kane joins us every couple of weeks or so to talk about stuff. Nancy, it's good to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
Uber and other companies call this surge pricing. American consumers call it price gouging. Is there middle ground here somewhere?
I don't think so. I think this is price.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
I think this is price gouging. I think, you know, they have a long, complicated and, you know, theoretically correct explanation for it about supply and demand.
Right.
But consumer behavior and brand loyalty and collective senses of fairness and, you know, decisions about when to hail a taxi or push the button on your iPhone don't hinge on theoretical models.
Maybe we should lay out the market dynamics here, right? Their theory is that only by charging higher prices and thus letting drivers profit more can we get them out in a snowstorm like there was last weekend in New York City. And thus those prices are justified because it helps meet the demand and it gets people on the road. It gets drivers on the road.
And, you know, again, that I think makes very good, very pristine, economic, logical sense. But a minimum ride cost $175 in New York last week. And I was standing there on Madison Avenue. We were thinking about getting in an Uber car. So to go a block up from, say, Madison and 57th to Madison and 58th would have cost my colleague and I $175.
Right.
I'm sorry. Right. That is way above what it takes to get drivers, many of whom are, you know, otherwise unoccupied limo drivers on the streets and in their town cars.
How much of the public's reaction to this, though, is our affinity for stability in prices, We want to know what something's going to cost and when it's going to cost.
Right. And when we want it to fluctuate, we want it to fluctuate downward.
In our
Thank
favor.
You very
That's
much.
Right. That's right.
No question. That's operating here. No question. On the other hand, it's not like we haven't encountered differentials in prices around heavy usage or high demand. Here, Uber, in a sense, has all the power. And so the rich, the very rich,
right.
get access and the rest of us don't. I think that's where the insult to fairness and where the upset about fluctuation comes.
Sustainable as a business model, do you think?
Absolutely not. I mean, we're living, remember, Kai, in an age where consumer rage and consumer reaction has lighter fluid underneath the fire,
yeah.
right? I really think Travis Kalanick is playing with fire here. Yeah.
The CEO. Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
It's all over but the presidential signature for the federal budget, the next 2 years' worth of it anyway. But don't let a compromise deceive you. There is still little real agreement in Washington about exactly how the government ought to spend money. Case in point, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, a new high-tech jet, which is also, as it happens, the most expensive weapons program ever and a congressional favorite all at the same time. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Joint Strike Fighter, or F-35, is way over budget and years behind schedule. But Congress hasn't clipped its wings. To understand why, you need to talk to people like Eddie Lynch. Lynch is one of thousands of Lockheed Martin workers who make the plane in Fort Worth, Texas. Each morning, Lynch gets out of his truck wearing his trademark plaid shirt and jeans. He walks into a mile-long factory and clocks in. Lynch helps assemble the plane's cockpit. It's a good, steady job, and Lynch is proud of what he does.
It's a great aircraft. It's new technology, the best in the world right now. It's being put together here, so I'm very impressed with it.
Lockheed says the F-35 is the most flexible, technologically sophisticated fighter ever. There are three versions of the plane for the Air Force, Navy, and Marines. The idea was to have one plane and save money, but that's easier said than done. The F-35 is at least 50% over budget. So why hasn't it been pared back? Well, production has already started, even though the plane is still in the testing phase. It's called front-loading by F-35 critics like Chuck Spinney, a retired Pentagon weapons development expert.
Basically, the front-loading operation is aimed at getting the program started and get the money flowing before the consequences of that program are fully understood.
Spinney says that money pays for lots of jobs. Lockheed says the F-35 is responsible for about 125,000 jobs in 46 states. Spinney says the jobs are spread around congressional districts, so the F-35 has lots of friends in lots of places.
The whole idea here is to carpet bomb the congressional districts with jobs, dollars, and profits.
Spinney says the carpet bombing worked. There have been little tweaks to the F-35 program, but Congress hasn't voted for major reductions. Who wants to cut jobs in their own district? Enter sequestration, the automatic spending cuts that Congress agreed to a few years ago, and a less politically painful way to cut the F-35. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says sequestration lets members of Congress avoid tough votes.
Don't blame me. I didn't vote to cut this particular program. Sequester did the cutting. It's not my fault. I was against the sequester.
But now sequestration will be pared back, at least for a couple of years. The F-35 will likely be spared any cuts, at least for now. And members of Congress will continue to be reminded that F-35 jobs in their districts are at stake. Which brings us back to Eddie Lynch, our Lockheed worker in Fort Worth. I asked him, does he ever write his member of Congress?
Well, I don't even have to write to her. She's here pretty often.
Lynch says Congresswoman Kay Granger visits the plant about 10 times a year.
We tour the plant with her, and she's always open for questions, and she takes time to hear us out, whatever we want to talk about. You know, we see her up and down the assembly line quite often.
Often enough to remind Granger that her constituents support the F-35, even depend on it, and don't want her to cut it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's something that allowed us to glow and dim.
And it's going away. But first, Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 11 points today, less than a 10th percent, ended at 16,179. The NASDAQ subtracted that same 11 points, about 3/10 percent, closed at 4,058. The S&P 500 shaved off about a point, less than a 10th percent, finished at 1,809. Facebook dropped nearly 1% today after announcing a stock offering of 70 million shares, including more than 40 million from founder Mark Zuckerberg. The sale comes as many index funds need to buy Facebook because it's now part of the S&P 500. But Facebook remains, by the by, a privately controlled public company. Zuckerberg still owns more than 60% of its voting power. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please, help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. New numismatists take note. U.S. Treasurer Rosie Rios has plans for a currency signing in D.C. For those in the mood for a little singing, it's Go Caroling Day. And while you're switching on holiday lights, think of Thomas Edison. On this day in 1879, he gave a private audience a taste of his new invention, the incandescent light bulb. More on that a little later in the show. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All this week, Stephen Beard has been making a grand tour of Europe of sorts. He's reporting on the young and out of work on the continent. We're calling the series Jobless Generation because a lot of Europe's biggest economies have youth unemployment rates that you could fairly call astronomical. Italy is out of recession now, but business leaders there say the recovery is going to be slow and it's going to be tough. Toughest of all, perhaps, for young Italians, whose unemployment rate is around 35%. From Rome, here's Stephen.
The churches and the classical architecture are among the glories of Italy, and so is the foundation stone of its society, the strength and warmth of the family. But cracks are beginning to appear in that critical institution. Even the most loving families are under pressure from ever-rising youth unemployment.
When I talk with my father, with my mother, they can't understand our situation. They think that find a job, it's really simple.
24-year-old Christina Lupo has been unemployed or in unpaid work since graduating more than a year ago. Her parents support her, but a little grudgingly now.
They say to me that you don't know how to find a job. You are a negative person.
Firing off 5 job applications a day, Christina finds the criticism hard to take from a generation that she says had an easier start in life.
My mother, after the graduation, after all 2 weeks, she found a job. For me, it's impossible. After 2 weeks of graduation, it's a dream. For our generation, it's a dream.
Other young Italians complain about older people hogging the jobs. They claim there's a fetish about seniority, that the nation is so much in love with antiquity, so intent on preserving its ancient ruins, that one of them is even running the country.
We have a president that I personally like, but he's 90, basically.
University researcher Luigi Maiorano.
Can we find somebody who is 60 or so to be the president of the country? Don't we have anyone like that?
Maiorano, who's in his 30s, has to hop from one short-term contract to another. A permanent university job only comes with middle age. He says this emphasis on age and not merit leads to higher youth unemployment and economic stagnation.
This is not a meritocratic society, in your view?
No, not the university, not the society.
The older generation is fighting back. 80-year-old Rosario Nicoletti retired as a professor at Rome University at the age of 76. He agrees that Italy is turning into a gerontocracy, but he says the young are partly to blame.
The fault is also in the young generation, which are not able to replace the old people. The young people are less and less skilled.
He claims the country's record high youth unemployment is largely due to the callowness of many young Italians.
the young generation live in an environment protected by their parents.
You're saying the young have had it too easy.
Yeah, they have a too easy life.
More than half of all 18 to 34-year-olds here are still living at home. Bambiaccini, a government minister, once called them. It means big babies or mollycoddled youth. Another minister accused the young unemployed of being too choosy in looking for their first job, unprepared to get their hands dirty. 32-year-old unemployed graduate Claudia Bernardi.
I'm not choosy.
Would you wait at tables? Would you work in a cafe? Would you sweep the floors?
I already did it, so I don't understand because after 13 years of studies, I have to do it again.
So why does she think she's too good for menial work?
I mean, I'm too much qualified and maybe even too much smart to sweep the floor after having one degree and one PhD. So maybe I am qualified for other work.
Thousands of young, unemployed but highly qualified Italians have flown the nest and gone to look for work abroad, in a more vibrant, flexible economy, in a city where youth is an advantage. Tomorrow we'll find out how some of them are faring in London. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
When you think about the really big names in online retailing, just a couple of companies probably come to mind. Amazon, of course, eBay, maybe Apple, for music anyway. Let's add another to the list, though. Just 8 years after it started, Etsy does almost $1 billion a year in annual transactions.
The boss will see you now.
So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, the guy who has been running Etsy for the past 5 years, Chad Dickerson is his name, and I started by asking him if the sellers on the site, people who do arts and crafts and sell vintage goods, small business people in other words, if they are doing all the work, what does the company do?
We run a really huge technology platform. Transactions happen in 200 countries around the world, and I think before Etsy, it would have been difficult if you were an artisan, you know, working in London to connect with a buyer, say, in Australia. So we've made that really easy. And we've done it at a really low cost to sellers. So when you sell something on Etsy, Etsy takes 3.5%, but the artist gets 96.5%.
What do you do running this company? What is your job as the CEO?
Yeah, so Etsy as a business is a pretty complex business. So we're building you know, the website software on the internet. We have over 30 million registered members on Etsy. That's literally the size of a small country. It's more than, if I have my numbers right here, I think it's more than the country of Australia. And in some sense, my job is almost like a political job in that you're leading a community. It's not a nation, but it is a coherent community.
10 years from now,
yeah.
Assuming, first of all, you're still here.
Right.
Second of all, that this company has more likely than not gone public. What is Etsy going to look like?
Sure. I think, you know, what I see Etsy doing is changing the way things are made. I think the ethos of Etsy, this idea that like buying and selling should be all about people, will start extending into areas like manufacturing and distribution and all of these things. So when I think about what Etsy can do over the next 10 years, 20 years, it's really humanizing the whole supply chain. And you can see hints of this already today. For example, we knew that our sellers were starting to do wholesale deals with retailers. Mm-hmm. And so we built a wholesale platform. And if, for example, you go to Nordstrom in Seattle or San Francisco or Chicago, there's a display of Etsy merchandise from a local Etsy seller.
I wonder, though, doesn't that take it out of the mom-and-pop phase? When you see stuff in Nordstrom from Etsy.
So one of our sellers who was doing Etsy to really kind of as an escape from the rigors of nursing school, she started to achieve success and some exposure. Fast-forwarding, she was noticed by Nordstrom and did a deal with Nordstrom. And now not only has she quit her job, but her husband quit his finance job to help her. And in this particular case, use the phrase mom and pop. This is literally a mom and pop. Etsy is really about making a life, not just a living. So we're just giving them the ability to grow and really change their lives.
What's the best thing you bought on Etsy ever?
Wow. That's like asking which is your favorite child.
Well, you know, come on.
So I have a computer bag that I really love that I bought from a seller in Germany, and it's made from a French army tent, a bomber jacket, a leather bomber jacket, and I think it's a Navy kit bag. And it's interesting, wherever I go, people ask me where I got it, and of course I tell them I got it on Etsy, and they say, I want one. And I say, well, you can't get one exactly like this.
Well,
like,
that's so funny, because I was just going to say, man, I need a new computer bag. Chad Dickerson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
We're nearing end of days for 40 and 60 watt incandescent light bulbs. They are being replaced under federal law by more energy efficient lighting, CFLs and LEDs, with a different kind of, and let's face it, a colder kind of light. As of the beginning of the new year, incandescent 40s and 60s won't be made here or imported here, and so will slowly begin to disappear from store shelves. Marketplace's Adrian Hill bids them farewell.
We gather here to say goodbye to the 40 and 60 watt incandescent light bulb.
Oh my God. I mean, tears are coming to my eyes. I'm kidding, but I'm not really kidding.
Kathy Prisgoda is principal lighting designer for Light Studio LA.
It's something that allowed us to glow and dim.
L.A. interior designer Ruth Stork has worked with and known these bulbs for years.
I think it's a feeling that you're going to miss. It's the feeling of a space that has a natural warmth to it, and that really comes from lighting.
We know, like all creations, this bulb wasn't perfect. It burned hot. It was wasteful. But we celebrate. The new generation owes its success to the passing generation. We've asked the inventor of the bulb to share his thoughts, Thomas Edison, via Edison impersonator R.J. Lindsay.
Well, I suppose I could use the title that's been applied, the Wizard of Menlo Park.
How do you feel, Mr. Edison, that your incandescent light bulb is now being phased out?
Well, I'll tell you, if I were still inventing, I would have invented whatever they're going to phase me out with.
Derek Porter is a professor at Parsons, the New School for Design. We've asked him for the appropriate epitaph.
Best wishes, warm friend.
Best wishes, warm friend. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one last taper-related item, and then I promise we'll move on. You've heard the phrase, the Fed's balance sheet, I'm sure, a lot since the worst of the financial crisis. In other words, it's a measure of exactly how much cash the Fed has been trying to add to the economy by buying bonds and other securities. So, as of the close of business yesterday, the Fed held on its books $4.04 trillion with a T dollars worth of assets. Back in 2008, before the apocalypse, about $800 million. They skipped right over billions with a B, did the Fed. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow Industrials up about 11 points. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hearst, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. Managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. We will see you tomorrow. Oh, yeah, and this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.